You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to the January 4th, 2021 edition of Mountain Money, our first broadcast of the new year. This is Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, and a beautiful morning it is. A little nippy out there, but that's great for the skiing.
And we're supposed to get a little bit of snow over the next couple of days. And so hopefully we'll get some more snow. I think a lot of the holiday crowds, which were certainly not up to normal, but were pretty substantial, will be leaving in the next day or so, leaving us some slopes to ski on. And meanwhile, this morning, we've got a pretty good show for you. Our first guest this morning will be Jake Wood, co-founder and CEO of Team Rubicon, who'll be joining us to talk about his veteran-led nonprofit disaster relief organization and what efforts they are providing to help with COVID-19 impacts.
And our second guest is going to be Robert Metzger. He is a prominent legal voice in the federal contracting community. He's going to join us to talk about the SolarWinds cyber breach and what it means for private businesses. And then we're going to speak with co-owners Ignacio Rosenberg and Randy Strong. They're going to join us to talk about a new Gracie Barr Jiu-Jitsu Academy that they're opening right here in Park City. All this and more today on Mountain Money. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our first guest this morning is going to be Jake Wood. He is the co-founder and CEO of Team Rubicon. Team Rubicon is a veteran-led nonprofit disaster relief organization that leverages the unique skills and experiences of military veterans to respond to natural disasters and humanitarian crises across the nation. Team Rubicon allows veterans to find renewed sense of purpose with like-minded individuals, and this not-for-profit organization has been actively serving communities suffering from COVID-19 impacts while continuing to deploy gray shirt volunteers to areas devastated by wildfires, hurricanes, and other natural disasters. Team Rubicon has strategically placed themselves at the forefront of disaster to help when and where it is needed. Jake, thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on. First show of the year.
First show of the year, first guest of the year. So I gave a little bit of a background of Team Rubicon. Anything I left out that you'd like to share that your group focuses on or is the mission of your group?
Yeah, I think you provided a great introduction. I think if anything, I'd love to just highlight that one of the things we're really known for is innovation. And that innovation spans both technological innovation. We've done some really incredible work with partners like Microsoft to build powerful tools, leveraging things like artificial intelligence. And the tools that we're building, we're actually giving away to other nonprofits for free. Beyond that, we're also just innovating in our general work. You know, we are constantly finding better ways of doing our core capabilities, delivering our services into these communities more effectively and more efficiently.
Jake, let's take a step back. What is it about your military experience and about the military experience of your volunteers that has sort of driven this notion of creating an organization of this kind?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if you think about a disaster zone, outside of the battlefield, it's probably one of the most chaotic situations imaginable. There's limited information, there are limited resources, obviously all sorts of natural stressors, poor information, misinformation, all of those things. And, you know, what the military does very well is it trains men and women to be able to keep their heads in those types of environments, to identify objectives, to build operational plans, to execute complex logistics in those types of scenarios. And so what we're doing is we're leveraging all of those skills and experiences and tapping into it to build effectively a better mousetrap in disaster zones. You know, my particular background, I didn't serve in a logistics capacity. I wasn't an operational planner in the military. I was the pointy end of the spear. I was a Marine scout sniper. And so none of those skills that you would typically associate with being a sniper are directly applicable. But I'll tell you what, the ability to keep your head, your calm in the midst of that chaos, the ability to lead or to follow in those types of situations, and really that relentless commitment to mission accomplishment can't be overrated when you're talking about sending people into these types of situations.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that ability to do your job in a time of extreme stress, I think a lot of us experience just a taste of that in March, where maybe for the first time in our lives, we're facing a really scary situation right here at home. And I certainly gained an appreciation for that. Roger's question was, you know, what was it about the your service background that helps with the mission? I want to know what is a similar question but different. What your organization has grown from 8 volunteers to 120,000 volunteers. I'm assuming almost all of those are veterans. What is it about your mission, do you think, that really resonates with veterans that has allowed your organization to grow like this?
Well, you know, this is a high-stakes mission, right? And, you know, as I mentioned previously, there are many parallels to the battlefield. The battlefield is obviously the highest-stakes mission that you'll find on planet Earth. But this is really close. You know, these are communities that have been devastated. You have residents of those communities, whether it's an American community or a global community, that are experiencing the worst moment of their life. In some of those moments, there are life and death consequences, certainly for some of the COVID-19 medical work that we've been doing throughout 2020. You know, the stakes were life and death. And so I think that for veterans, you know, it's that high stakes, the opportunity to generate tremendous impact. And listen, I'm not going to lie to you. There's an element of adventure and adrenaline to this as well. I mean, many of these men and women are coming back. They find that life has lost a little bit of its flavor. It's not quite as exciting as it used to be. In many ways, that's a good thing. Don't get me wrong. I got out of the military because I felt like I was getting a little too used to, you know, I guess the exhilaration of being deployed in combat zones. But, you know, I think that that's an element of this as well. At the end of the day, these men and women that are serving with Team Rubicon, they're tremendous Americans. These are people that have service in their hearts. They want to add value to their communities. They want to put others before themselves. I mean, these are, you know, they hold all of the highest virtues that we think of when we think of, you know, American ideals. That's what these people embody.
You know, one of the interesting things and really wonderful things about your organization is that we know that so many veterans come back. They have this incredible skill set, and they don't really know how to apply the lessons they learned in the military to civilian life, which can often lead to frustration and depression. So I think your ability to sort of help people marshal those skills into a useful post-military career has really, really been amazing. And I think have you found that the volunteers really get a rewarding experience out of this because it enables them to use those skills?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as a government, we invest hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the training of these men and women. We train them to the highest standards on the latest equipment, and we expect them to execute that in really tough situations. And when those people get out, they often don't find, as you mentioned, an opportunity to continue to apply those skill sets. And so, you know, giving them that outlet, you know, is really helpful for them. And I think they also discover a new career field. I don't think many people understand that emergency management is one of the fastest growing career fields in the country. By the way, that's a bad thing. It means that we are facing an increasing onslaught of disasters that are becoming more severe and more costly. It means that we are having more volatility in our neighborhoods as a result of things like racial injustice and economic inequality. But, you know, this is an opportunity to apply those skills in a new growing career field that pays well and has great career opportunities.
So let's talk about some of your projects. The projects before March of 2020 are probably very different than they are today. Talk to us about some of your bigger projects that you're working on today, including COVID.
Sure. Well, you know, 2020 was challenging, to say the least. We came into the year fully expecting a challenging hurricane season, which of course lived up to its billing. We had thousands of volunteers that deployed across the Gulf Coast area, you know, starting with the first hurricane to hit Southwest Louisiana and spanning, I think, 5 hurricane landfalls along about a 500-mile stretch of coast there from the Florida Panhandle through Louisiana and East Texas. And, you know, and in between that, all sorts of wildfires and floods. Right now, we have some big things going on, again, with COVID. We are running a medical mission in Navajo Nation. Navajo Nation is one of the most vulnerable and underserved populations in America. This is actually the second time that we have deployed into Navajo Nation for medical support. We deployed there earlier in COVID-19 when that was the fastest growing outbreak in the country. We treated over 3,000 patients that first time around. We've been back there since late November. We've treated another 1,000 patients. It's pretty bad. Beyond that, we're working in Arizona in both Pima and Maricopa counties on vaccination programs. Obviously, with two vaccines now approved in the U.S., our country is facing the largest logistical challenge in our nation's history. You know, larger than the landing at Normandy on D-Day, larger than the Berlin airlift, larger than anything we've ever done. And Team Rubicon is positioning everything that we have to help get into that fight. And so we're doing some pilot programs in Pima and Maricopa County right now, as well as with the healthcare system in North Carolina called Atrium Health, doing everything from actually sticking needles in arms with our medical providers, but also doing a lot of the wraparound services, you know, things like patient registration, patient and vehicle flow, post-vaccination monitoring, really trying to decompress the healthcare providers so they can focus on what they do best. You know, we see this vaccination rollout as a whole of country effort, and we intend to do everything we can to be a part of it.
Help us understand, sort of as a practical matter, how a mission like the Navajo mission evolves. How do you interface with local public health and local governmental authorities, and how do you fund something like that?
Well, I'll answer the last part first. The organization is funded entirely by philanthropy, and so we rely on generous contributions from individuals, foundations, and corporations to fund the work. So when we're looking at something like Navajo Nation, you know, we're relying on, at first, unrestricted funding that we have from individual donors. And then, you know, in order to expand or sustain a mission like that, we're really looking to find a patron who will take a specific interest in that mission. We were lucky in that we found one, a very wealthy donor from the Silicon Valley area who wanted to support and expand that mission. And so we're very fortunate. The interfacing and the planning is complex, as you can imagine. We have over 3,000 counties and parishes across the United States, and that's really where the rubber meets the road at the county level. So it's almost impossible to maintain all 3,000 of those relationships, but we do a pretty good job because we have tremendous volunteers in almost all of those counties who we've empowered to do that initial liaising with those public health and emergency management officials. In a situation like Navajo Nation, we've worked in Navajo Nation several times over the course of our history, like I said, most recently early in the pandemic. And so that request actually came directly from them. They reached back out to us and said, hey, we need support. You know, can you send your medical teams back in? But you hit the spot there. That is one of the most critical functions that we have to execute effectively, is that interagency coordination.
And let's talk about this interaction that needs to take place, and maybe take a step back at the logistics. Help our audience understand the complexity. You mentioned that it's the most complex logistical effort our country's ever faced. Paint a picture for that so people understand the complexity of what we're seeing. It's not like when I took my 3-year-old daughter into her doctor to get her immunization shots. This is very different. Help paint the picture as to why this is so complex and why this is so difficult.
Yeah, well, there's a multitude of reasons for why. Let's start with the vaccines themselves. These are vaccines that are requiring cold storage. One obviously requires much, much colder storage than the other. I think near negative 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which there just simply aren't that many facilities that can actually store one of those two vaccines. That most facilities can't store the second one. But, you know, that requires cold shipping, that requires the cold storage, that requires effective processes on site so that vaccines are being taken out of storage just in time to be put into arms and they're not spoiling on countertops. So, you know, we have those challenges. Beyond that, the federal government has really abdicated any responsibility for the execution of this campaign. And I think that's a mistake. I believe that empowering local governments is in most cases a positive thing. But I think it's moments like this that a strong federal response is critical. And so what we're seeing is that this rollout is happening across 50 states plus all of our territories, as well as at the tactical level, 3,000 counties and parishes who are all taking different approaches. And so, you know, there's just a challenge in communicating to your local population who's eligible for a vaccine, where they can get it, when they can get it. Even the challenge that I think people are talking about but not really understanding is people have to come back for a second one. So So it's not just about sticking 350 million needles in arms one time. It's about getting the right window and timing to bring those people back to get a second one to ensure, you know, that the vaccination is fully taken root. That's a massive informational and logistics challenge that I don't think is getting enough airtime right now. That's really going to play and I think reveal the inadequacies of some of our electronic medical record systems and other database systems.
And it is really interesting to see the disparate things that are happening across the country with respect to vaccination percentages. And then you compare it with something like Israel, who've already already inoculated, 10-15% of the population already. We all see this as a problem. Where are you seeing a more effective approach to vaccinations? What do you have any examples of states or counties that you can point to and say, yeah, that's probably how we ought to do it?
Well, you know, I would hesitate to, you know, call out specific counties for what they're doing well or what they're doing poorly. But I think there are some elements that we have to think about rolling out on a larger scale in order for this to, you know, to really rise to the challenge here. We can't be vaccinating people 9 to 5 at just a handful of facilities. We have to ensure that we're providing 24-hour access to vaccinations. We have to roll this out to, you know, Little League baseball parks and vaccinate people, you know, that are dropping off their kids at Little League. We have to roll this out to, you know, every Walgreens in the country. We have to get this at schools and community centers and churches. You know, again, I mentioned earlier that this has to be a whole of nation effort. We have to rethink access to this vaccine in order for it to be effective. right now, the current 9 to 5 limited distribution approach is going to result in a limited vaccination outcome.
Yeah, and Jake, I don't want to make this totally about COVID because your team's mission is much broader than that. So I want to get back to Team Rubicon. We mentioned the military veterans. For those listening in the audience, you also have people serving that have never been in the military. Tell us about how they can help, and if they want to find out more, how they can approach your organization.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we have about 25% of our volunteers have never worn a uniform, and that's amazing. That's great, because what they're saying is that they're choosing to serve here and now, and we welcome them with open arms. There's no difference in how you serve or where you serve or when you serve once you join. Everybody wears the same uniform in Team Rubicon. We'll provide everybody with the training that they need to have impact on the ground. You know, serving with Team Rubicon is pretty straightforward. You can go to our website, www.teamrubiconusa.org. You can register as a volunteer there. A lot of your initial training is online, and you'll, you know, enter into our volunteer management system, and all of your local opportunities for service, all of your local leadership connections can be found right there, and we make it as simple as possible. I'll say that you know, the Colorado, Utah area for us, where most of your listeners are, is one of our most active territories across the country. And so there's plenty of opportunities to plug in that general area.
You know, this is a really obviously very positive program for returning veterans. The last several years, there's been a lot of controversy about the degree of mental health services being provided by the Veterans Administration and the quality of that program. Do you have any observations on where things are going in that respect? How good a job is the VA doing, and how could it be improved?
You know, I think the VA has been improving. I think it has much improvement yet to do. Listen, I think that the mental health issues facing our veterans are very complex. I think often people I think all too often we are anxious to slap the post-traumatic stress label on individuals mm-hmm. who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I think one positive of these wars is that we've finally taken an issue like PTSD seriously. We're not sweeping it under the rug like we did after Vietnam and other wars. This is a real issue, but I think we're often also misdiagnosing this. I think that there are other complex psychological and behavioral issues that people come home from. I mean, ranging from PTSD through things like moral injury. Moral injury may have some of the same symptoms as PTSD, but you can't treat moral injury with drugs, right? And moral injury is, you know, it's what happens when somebody does something, takes an action that violates a deeply held belief that often comes from childhood. It often comes from a religious upbringing. And often we'll see those people, they become more reclusive, they become more distant with friends and family as they might feel some sense of shame. Well, you don't treat that the same way you do with post-traumatic stress, which is actually a physiological adaptation of the brain resulting from heightened hormone levels from your time in a combat zone. And so I think, you know, we just have to be willing to address these things for what they are. I'm a firm believer that most men and women are coming back from their experiences overseas stronger than when they left. I think that many of them, despite having experienced trauma, have grown stronger as a result of that trauma. But we have to convince them of that. We have to challenge them to be leaders in their community, to come home and to put their skills to use, to build a better America, to make a stronger and more resilient America. And that's really what we're in a battle for right now, is a battle for that narrative. If we tell all these men and women that they're broken, they're going to think they're broken. They're going to act like they're broken. And ultimately, they will be broken. If we tell them that they have the potential to be the next greatest generation in this country, they'll rise up to that challenge.
You know, before we go, I want to talk a little bit about the book. What motivated you to write it, and what exactly what were you trying to accomplish with it?
Yeah, so I wrote my book, really a memoir called Once a Warrior, last year. Well, really in 2019. It was published last year in 2020. What prompted me to write it? I think that there were a handful of things. One, my first daughter was born at the end of 2018, and that really forced me to want to put my life and my journey in perspective for her. You know, my time overseas in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan as a sniper, I knew that at some point, you know, whether it was going to be in 10 or 15 or 20 years, she was going to ask me about those experiences, and I was going to owe her a truthful answer. And so writing the book was in part, you know, a way for me to help make sense of my own experiences for her sake. But beyond that, you know, I'm pretty sickened by the dialogue, the rhetoric, the division that I see in this country today. It's not the country that I went overseas to fight for. And I think that in my decade leading Team Rubicon, I have seen the best of American. I've seen American communities come together after tragedy. I've seen, you know, Americans who are volunteering with Team Rubicon deploy to communities they've never been to help people they've never met. It's one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen. And America deserved to know that story. They deserve to be inspired by it just like I have. And so I really wanted to memorialize those stories as well as my time overseas to really show the complexity of the veteran experience, the complexity of coming home, but also why America should be hopeful for the future.
That's a great note for us to wrap on. However, I am going to ask you one last question because I think it's really important, and that is employers. And encouraging employers to reach out and to hire returning service people, as we talk, they have many, many skills. I want to give you 30 seconds, our last question, our last response, to make that pitch to employers to hire returning veterans.
Yeah, well, hey, listen up. These are men and women who, you know, they're team players. They're highly trainable. They're very adaptable. And I would just encourage you to look beyond the resume. They will certainly have an unconventional resume. They might not have all the boxes checked that you're looking for, but trust that these are people that you want on your team. They make your company better. They make it stronger. They make it more resilient. You may have to invest a little bit in their training, but I guarantee you it's an investment that's going to pay off and pay dividends. So take a chance on them.
Okay. And on that note, we will wrap. Our guest this morning has been Jake Wood. He is the co-founder and CEO of Team Rubicon, as well as author of the book Once a Warrior. Jake, thank you for joining us this morning. And Mountain Money will return in a moment. Please stay tuned.
On December 13th, news first broke of the massive SolarWinds cybersecurity breach. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, a division of the Department of Homeland Security, issued an emergency directive ordering federal civilian agency to remove SolarWinds software from their networks. Some 18,000 SolarWinds customers were affected, including critical government agencies such as the Department of Homeland Security and many major American corporations. Multiple sources have attributed the attack to the SVR, the Russian intelligence agency.
So what do we know about the real scope and impact of the attack? How did it work as a practical matter? What are the implications of the breach going forward, and how can integrity be restored to affected systems? What kind of systems were in place to try to prevent such attack, and why did they fail? And finally, if anything should be changed in the American cybersecurity defense structure going forward because of these attacks?
We're lucky to have with us nationally known cybersecurity expert Bob Metzger. Bob is a partner in the Rogers Joseph O'Donnell Law Firm. He's written extensively on cybersecurity issues in the government and commercial context, and I would be remiss not to point out that he was an early supervisor of mine from whom I learned a great deal as a young lawyer. Welcome to Mountain Money, Bob.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Bob, let's start with some background. Can you help the audience understand what exactly happened here?
Well, it is difficult to understand because there really is no precedent for an attack of this sophistication, complexity, and potential implications. You know, we're all used to hearing stories about how a breach gets into a network system and confidential files are stolen. But this is much more than that. The adversary that mounted this attack went to a great deal of trouble and took a lot of time to establish essentially a virtual infrastructure within the United States, which it could then use to infiltrate into network systems of government agencies and large corporations. The nature of the malware that it installed was especially pernicious because it included setting up a communications link to a command and control server that could give it additional and different instructions. It's thought that the attack could not only allow an adversary to look at emails and seize files, but also to have access to operating systems to influence or affect calls to other applications. And it was even possible for the attackers to move laterally from the system that they first penetrated into other systems within a network, and potentially outside the network of one company or one entity into another. So we start with a concern, Roger, that emails might have been monitored or information may have been exfiltrated, potentially from a large number of companies. We have to think further about the possibility that backdoors remain implanted in many networks that could be used for even more hazardous purposes, such as the interruption of critical functions, or just for illustration, the placement of ransomware attacks across a variety of government agencies as well as commercial activities.
Yeah, no, the scale of this is really unprecedented. And as you mentioned, there are these back doors, which for the audience that may not have heard of it, it essentially is what it sounds like. It's a way for the bad guys to gain access again. And that's really my first question for you, Bob, is how do we make sure that these back doors are discovered and closed? And do we just have to live with the reality that there very well may be back doors that we'll never find?
Well, it's, again, unusually difficult, if not unprecedented. You know, typically, if you have an experience where a breach is discovered, you take a forensic image, essentially an electronic copy of your system. You then have the experts go through it. You find the malware. You remove it, and then you rebuild the system. Well, here we have systems upon systems that may have been compromised. And the nature of the malware itself is extraordinarily complicated. It was done in ways specifically designed to mimic what should be authentic software from the SolarWinds company, or to mimic authentic and proper methods of identification and authorization for access. So no one is going to be content to live with this risk. But the effort to find it and remove it will be prodigious. One of the releases from the government essentially tells potentially affected agencies that they have to disconnect many of their operative systems, shut them down, and then essentially rebuild them from scratch, essentially installing new software and creating new authorizations for personnel to have access, so that you are essentially rebuilding the entire stack, hopefully with secure content, and not allowing yourself to remain vulnerable to a poisoned residue that you could not find otherwise.
It sounds like it would be an astoundingly expensive and time-consuming process to rebuild it. Is that really what most of these corporations are going to have to do?
I don't think that most corporations will do it, in fact, because they'll look for other alternatives that are less costly. already we are seeing a number of the most sophisticated private concerns emerge with different tactics and techniques to find the malware or to reduce the vulnerability or to mitigate the consequence. There will be perhaps more of that than the complete rebuild. It's for government agencies where the problem is particularly acute. No one in the government wants to be operating a system which could be deliberately compromised in a time of crisis. No one at the State Department wants to fear that routine emails among diplomats or other State Department personnel, you know, could be observed at the whim of a foreign intelligence service. So we'll see that there is a spectrum of responses. Some companies will try to find the poison that is most easily detectable. Others will introduce new methods of security and authentication, essentially trying to close off the existing avenues of access now that their type and character have been identified.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is why a company like SolarWinds, which probably nobody had ever heard of, I suppose the closest they've ever heard of was the Seals and Crofts song Summer Breeze, but how it is that a company like SolarWinds and infiltrating it could have such a dramatic impact. What did they do, and why are they in so many places?
Well, that's a great question. You know, our country is the most networked of the major actors geopolitically. And increasingly, the networks that we use are highly interdependent and rely upon assets of great scale and complexity, especially cloud-based systems. So SolarWinds occupies an important position, albeit not a very visible one, in the commercial and government computing infrastructure. It essentially creates an application that allows enterprises to manage electronically and very efficiently all of the assets that may be on a network, storage, firewalls, workstations, computing resources. SolarWinds describes itself as providing to you essentially a single window, a single pane of glass where you can see at a glance all of the operations of dispersed and highly complex networks. Well, necessarily to have that function, the software must be highly trusted within organizations. It needs to be able to call on different servers and other devices within the network to get their status. It needs to be able to give them instructions. So there you have a trusted intermediary with tentacles, if you will, that reach everywhere within the networks of its clients. What the SVR did, if in fact they are the perpetrators, was to find a way to infiltrate the software build for that intermediary. They introduced at least one and perhaps several different vectors of attack into the software that was being built periodically by SolarWinds to update its application. All of us know that with our smartphones that that Apple or other providers are periodically going to update the operating system or the applications. We often let them do that in the background. We don't pay much attention to it. We trust to the security of the host or the application provider. Well, in this case, the poison software was delivered through that software supply chain and then uploaded periodically by thousands of companies who have relied upon SolarWinds to manage their network.
So I think all of us are thinking about our phones and our other software that we just automatically hit update on. And, you know, we're just average civilians. We most of us in the audience don't have expertise in this area. However, SolarWinds client list includes some of the most sophisticated tech companies in the country. How was it that large, sophisticated firms did not have the systems in place to detect this sooner? And what changes do you think that means going forward to protect systems like this?
Well, that's another important question. The nature of this attack and what we're learning about it ought to cause security professionals from every domain to rethink their assumptions. And it certainly ought to cause government to reconsider how it's going to approach the problem. Let's start with the last question, you know, perhaps what does the government do? I mean, traditionally, we look at security as a function of threat and vulnerability and consequence. Well, in this case, the threat wasn't seen. the national strategy, as is executed by the NSA, is to defend forward, meaning that we're supposed to plant ourselves into foreign networks to get early alerts to potential attacks so that we can defer, detect, avoid, deflect, or stop such attacks. Well, that didn't work because NSA wasn't the entity that found this attack. It was found by a private concern, FireEye. So we missed out on threat. And then the next thing that we're supposed to do is to know where vulnerabilities exist in our systems. And there are vulnerabilities which are inherent, meaning that they're there, and if you look hard enough, you'll see them and you'll close them. And there are vulnerabilities which are induced, meaning that adversaries can find a weak point or a weak process to insert a hostile code. Well, in this case, we didn't really see the vulnerabilities, and I say plural because there were more than one. They were definitely induced, and once induced, they were exploited. And then the last thing that we're supposed to think of are consequences. And in theory, we are supposed to have plans of resilience and recovery so that in the event of an attack, we can stop the damage, understand how what has occurred, and restore, remediate compromised systems. Well, we're not doing a great job on that either. So there needs to be a big rethink as to how we approach security. And also we have to think about roles and missions for government agencies. Right now, the NSA has no jurisdiction to look internally within the United States to study our networks and systems, government or commercial. That's against the law. CISA, the unit of the Department of Homeland Security, formerly headed by Chris Krebs, it has some jurisdiction, but some people say not enough. And maybe most importantly, we have a number of discrete stovepipes of different resources on threat, on vulnerability, and response. They all serve a common purpose, defending the national cyber infrastructure, but they do it under different columns and leadership. We need to have national leadership to deal with the problem, and I think we need to combine and consolidate our methods of intelligence so that we can learn much faster of attacks and respond vastly more quickly, bad phrasing, to attacks when we learn them. In this case, the adversaries initially penetrated the SolarWinds software long ago in March, which is an eternity, and it took, what, 8 months to begin to understand the problem. That is forever in the cyber world. We must act more expeditiously and must be informed more rapidly.
You know, Bob, you mentioned the concept of the NSA's somewhat limited jurisdiction, which for privacy concerns and other reasons has been a longstanding principle. But I'm also feeling a little bit like we have the same kind of silo problem that people referred to post 9/11, that there was not sufficient integration among different elements to react to cybersecurity in the current environment. Would you think that there needs to be some kind of more centralized ability to take this on? Is that what you're suggesting?
I am suggesting that. In fact, I recently co-authored an article on the subject that appears in the National Interest. After 9/11, it was realized that we had a lot of different agencies, law enforcement, military, and otherwise, who were concerned with terrorism, but they were not under one roof, so to speak. And so legislation was passed, and executive action was taken to establish the National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC. My article and that of others as well says that we have essentially the digital equivalent of a 9/11 now. And we need to create what we call a National Supply Chain Intelligence Center, following similar principles to bring together law enforcement, military intelligence, domestic intelligence, critical infrastructure, other agencies, civilian, and as well as the Department of Energy, so that we have essentially in one place all of the resources, all of the authorities that we will need to know more and act faster to future threats.
So, Bob, I want to ask a question that is going to seem silly to my wonderful co-host, Roger, here, who is also an attorney. But I think many folks might be surprised at your level, obviously, of sophistication and knowledge and your leadership role in here. I think the natural thought is, gee, it's going to be a technology person that's going to be leading this. Talk to us about your path here. And just for the younger people in our audience, how being a lawyer gave you the tools to help in a complex area like this that includes really high levels of technology?
That's a challenging question. I've always been interested in the intersection of law, technology, and policy, and they all come together here. You know, we are a nation of laws, excepting perhaps one person presently in the White House. We're a nation of laws, and we are a nation also of regulation. One of the challenges that's faced here is that responding to something like SolarWinds, it requires more than exhortation. It requires funding. It may require new laws. It could require new regulations. And it certainly will have an influence on how the government acquires goods and services. So my role in this has always been one that combines my knowledge of administrative law as well as federal procurement law and practice. I was on something called Defense Science Board, a study of cyber-physical systems, and it was largely a group of prominent scientists, engineers, and the like. There was one economist on the panel, and there was one lawyer. And my job essentially was to be a funnel where I could take some of the technical wisdom or insight of the scientific community and try to translate that into government policies, into new administrative actions, into new regulations, and potentially even into changes to statute. I have found it useful to have legal training to approach security issues. I am always striving to learn more about the technical content because I think that to be most effective, you have to get sort of outside the small box of law with a lowercase l, and you need to think, you know, bigger and across domains of law, policy, and technology.
Bob, we talked a little bit about how this is, in a sense, a cyber 9/11. Are we seeing any rumblings from either the Hill, and I recognize things are a little bit disruptive right now, but either the Hill or the Pentagon to create some kind of commission or other way to actually constructively try to go at what ought to be done next? Are we seeing sort of, is anyone on the Hill talking about putting together a 9/11 type commission?
Well, in fact, it's sort of already been done. There was something called the Cybersecurity Solarium Commission, which was a multi-year effort that was run by a number of congressmen from both parties. And it has produced a series of reports in 2020. And those culminated in several dozen recommendations for improved cyber organizations and measures that were included in the defense authorization measure for fiscal 2021. Many of you listening may recognize that just a few days ago, the Congress overrode President Trump's veto for the first time in his administration. And that new FY21 authorization is now law. Well, it includes a requirement that the president create essentially a national cybersecurity leader who would be within the White House, have a Senate-confirmed position, and have important authorities within the National Security Council. That's a key step. It also will lead to the enhancement of the powers and authorities, I think, of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And it certainly will get us on the way to having better organized and stronger measures across the federal government.
And
still, Congress is undoubtedly going to want to run its own study, commission, and review. But those take time, and we don't have time to wait for that output to act, in my view.
We've been talking to Bob Metzger about the SolarWinds breach. Bob, thanks for spending time with us this morning. We'll
Thank
be
you.
Right back after this.
Welcome back to Mound Money. Fascinating conversation about cybersecurity. It's scary out there, so let's all, on several fronts, so let's all be as safe as we can be. Our next conversation is going to be a little less serious, but also informative and fun. We've got the co-owners of a Gracie Barra Academy, which is going to be jiu-jitsu training. Their co-owners are Ignacio Rosenberg and Randy Strong. And Gracie Barra is a jiu-jitsu association with over 800 schools on six continents. And we're going to have our very own location here in Park City, scheduled to open on January 9th.
and their head professor will offer a variety of Brazilian jiu-jitsu programs that cater to students of all ages and abilities, from self-defense to competition-level training. The Park City Studio will embrace the world community of jiu-jitsu instructors, students, and athletes in the local areas. Thank you for joining us, both Ignacio and Randy.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So it's a brand new studio. We understand it's completing construction now. Give us a feel of what type of experience you're looking to create in your studio.
Well, you know, we both come from entertainment, so we wanted to put in a few design elements and surprises in there for people to discover as they go around. But we wanted it to be an upscale location. We wanted it to be really comfortable. Obviously, it's all directed towards training. The mat is the main thing, but you know, we wanted the seating area, the reception area, to be comfortable for parents bringing their kids or just to wait. It's a very community-based sport, so we wanted to make it a very welcoming environment.
Let's take a step back and talk a little bit about what Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is. Is it a martial art? Is it a dance? Tell us about what it actually is.
It's a martial art. It's a derivation of what traditional jiu-jitsu is in Japan. That was modified in Brazil to be much more functional. Obviously, you know, I'm South American. I'm from Argentina. Things down there are a little bit spicier, shall we say. So they took this martial art and started modifying it. So it was actually usable in the streets for self-defense. And that's how that became, that's what became so pervasive, because it is so useful. And then from then on, as it became more popular, at some point, we had to federate it so we could have competitions. So now there's a whole competition aspect of it.
I will add on there, though. So my background comes from, I'm a professional dancer. And I didn't think that I was going to like it at first. And when I started training, I found these ways to integrate. There's just a lot of movement that's happening, which I love. And so it's different from anything that I've ever tried. But I think people will be surprised how much you can integrate other forms of movement in the sport.
Yeah, and Randy, let's give a little bit of background. When you say you were a professional dancer, some of your credentials include So You Think You Can Dance, the Gilmore Girls, you worked with U.S. Figure Skating, and also you worked with Dancing with the Stars. So your credentials are quite impressive there. And it sounds like what attracted you to jiu-jitsu was kind of that movement and the flow. What do you think that's going to attract folks to jiu-jitsu here in Park City outside of self-defense? I mean, occasionally we have somebody that cuts in line in us in the ski line, and we have to take matters into our own hands. But outside of that, what do you think will be attractive to folks here in Park City?
Yeah, well, we thought it would be such a great fit. I mean, Park City is based around, you know, a community and health aspect, which obviously fits great in there. It's a different form of workout, but not only that, it provides empowerment and confidence that I don't think that you get from a lot of, you know, quote-unquote workouts. I kind of just tried it for the first time because my husband was doing it. And again, like I didn't think that I was going to love it. And I would encourage people to step outside of their comfort zone and just try a class, because I think that you'll be pleasantly surprised at how addicted you could become. And it's just something that I fell in love with. And I will add on there that like Iggy said, it's a community. We're building a community. And I feel like every time I step into any studio, any Gracie Barra, it's so welcoming. Everyone's so kind. The professors and even the students, they just want to help each other out. And there's a willingness to serve within these studios, which I think is awesome.
Tell us a little bit about your class structure. You know, what kind of offerings can the public access get access to it at the studio?
Yeah, so the sort of the biggest benefit of Gracie Barra in general around the world is that, you know, we have this giant network of schools and they're all independently owned, but we all follow the same curriculum. We're actually all synchronized in the same week. So you can leave our school in Park City, fly to Moscow, walk into a Gracie Barra in Moscow, and you'll be in the same week, the same curriculum. We have the same warm up. But obviously we all have different instructors and different owners, so the styles are different. But classes start. We have three programs for kids, which are basically built around anti-bullying. And a lot of this isn't just the techniques and you know how to diffuse the fight, but a lot of it comes down to confidence and walking with that knowledge that you can defend yourself. And I think that helps. The grown-up programs start. What we call GB1, which is the fundamentals. We teach you some of the basic movements. Some of the stuff is a bit alien. There's a lot of like moving your hips and stuff like that. But from then on, it just keeps growing as your belt ranking grows. And we built the schedule to fit around the normal necessities of people. So we have two early morning classes, and then we have an afternoon class. And as the school progresses, we'll start adding competition classes and what we call no gi, which is where you don't wear the uniform, but that'll be down the line.
An obvious question that we have to ask is, in this time, talk to us about the steps you're taking for COVID safety with your students.
Yeah, so you know, safety has always been a big thing in jiu-jitsu, not just because of whatever virus may be floating around, but you know, obviously we put a lot of trust in one another. We're exposing our necks and our joints, and you know, there's a lot of trust and safety. So we've always been very careful about that. We've just taken it to an nth degree now. We sanitize the mats in between every class. We have a special product that we put in with a sprayer gun. We clean the gym constantly. Obviously, there's temperature checks and masks and hand sanitizer. And we've sort of tweaked the schedule a bit so people don't congregate. So we can let one class let out completely before the other class comes in. Gracie Barra has done a jiu-jitsu versus COVID-19 certification that we've all had to take. So we all have our diplomas saying that we've taken this course. So we're definitely trying to do everything we can to keep this as safe as possible.
Okay, and let's end on that note of safety. And if people want to sign up or learn more, how can they do so?
Yeah, the best way to get in contact with us is visit our website at GB Park City. And then on social media, it's at GB Park City. We encourage you to just call or get in contact with us to schedule your free intro class. And hope to see you all on the mat.
Okay, sounds good. Ignacio and Randy, thank you for joining us this morning. And Mountain Money will be right back.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.